There are records of banking crises dating back as far as 600 years, but recently globalization has brought with it new risks that economic failures will spread around the world. When the U.S. financial crisis erupted in 2008, Britain and the rest of Europe saw it as a threat to their economies, and coping with it, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and his counterparts in the U.K. and Eurozone had plenty of history to draw upon, but they still had to develop novel solutions to problems that had never been seen before. In The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire, The Washington Post's Neil Irwin reveals how the three central bankers worked to put out the financial crisis fire. His book is from Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Irwin to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Over the past 5 years, numerous books have been published in this country exploring the causes of the crisis, like the housing bubble, banking, recklessness, deregulation. Most of them have focused on the U.S. financial system, but you look not just at the Fed, but at the Bank of England and the European Central Bank. Why specifically the central banks and why those three?
You know, I think this crisis we experienced in the United States that began with subprime mortgages back in 2007 and included the Lehman Brothers failure in 2008 and all the horrible things that we remember from that period of crisis, that really was just the beginning of the story. And what I've tried to do is explain how that was really a starting point for a global arc that traveled across to continental Europe, to Britain, into the banking system, into the financial markets, into the real economy and back again, and then how the central banks have dealt with that.
But Europe, why not China and Japan? Are they not important to this story?
They're important, but they're less part of this interlocking financial system story. So, you know, Japan has had kind of its own run the last few years, a lot of difficult economic circumstances, but it was much less affected by the U.S. subprime and the U.S. mortgage crisis. Same with China. China experienced an economic downturn because of less trade and less demand from the West, but it's less interlocked in the financial sense.
Well, Canada is our biggest trading partner. Was Canada a consultant?
Canada was consulted. They were often in the room in these G7s and G8s, and they're often in the room. But, you know, the fact is the Canadian economy did okay. They actually didn't have much of a housing bubble, and their banks were in good shape.
What makes a central bank central?
Well, it's, you know, governments over the centuries have found that they need to have some kind of organization in place to make these decisions of how to manage the money supply, how to interact with the banking system and the financial system, how to issue government debt, how to make sure the governments can fund themselves. And that's why there's this hundreds of years of history of governments setting up central banks that do that work for them.
But, well, there was the Swiss had the first central bank.
Sweden.
And then Britain established the Bank of England over 300 years ago in 1694. The United States didn't establish the Fed until 1913. Was Britain far ahead of its time, or was the U.S. just lagging behind?
We were a little behind the times. You know, it's amazing how these battles over whether to have a central bank, they're as old as the United States of America. I mean, you remember from history, the battles over the First Bank of the United States, the Second Bank of the United States. These were, you know, the argument was we just fought this revolution to cast off these Europeans, the Brits running things. Why would we have a new class running, being in charge and centralizing power? So there's a deep-seated aversion to having having central power in the United States.
Well, what had led to the establishment of the Bank of England?
The crown, the king needed a way to make sure he could fund the government. And you know what? It's interesting. The Bank of England, they played this crucial role that I don't think is well understood in the entire rise of the empire. The Bank of England played a crucial role in making sure that London was the financial center of the universe, and they stood ready to keep this ability to funnel savings from the countryside in England, from farmers, from merchants, into big investments in shipping and factories. That was enabled by this financial system developed in Victorian Britain and the Bank of England.
And why did the United States establish the Fed when it did, not earlier? Was it because the world was getting rather dangerous in 1913?
Well, it's a little more than that. We had a series of very difficult banking panics in the late 19th century. The worst one was 1907, and that was kind of enough is enough. And, you know, we saw this real push to say, among the elite, among the banking elite in the country, the political elite, to say, all right, if we want to be a kind of global financial capital, if we want New York to surpass London one day as the global financial capital, we need a central bank of our own.
Do all the central banks work pretty much the same?
There's a lot of subtle distinctions in how they operate, but you know they have more in common than not.
One of the key functions of the Fed is as the lender of last resort. What does that mean?
Well, it's this is a concept that goes back to Britain and the Bank of England. The idea is that when no one else wants to lend, if a central bank doesn't stand in the way and produce unlimited volumes of dollars or pounds or whatever the currency might be and be the lender of last resort, that the entire system can collapse and you can have a deflation and economic collapse.
And we're seeing that right now in the Eurozone, aren't we?
That's right, especially some countries where people don't have confidence in the banking system. They've been pulling money out of the banks, and therefore the economy gets in very bad shape, and it's a vicious cycle.
Who did the job of the Fed before it was created? How was the country's money supply controlled?
That's interesting. There were private banks all over the country, and they had clearinghouses to try and funnel money from the cities to the countryside when it was needed. It was kind of a private sector form of central banking. It proved not up to the challenges, though, of an increasingly modern economy in the 19th and early 20th centuries. That's why even the routine agricultural cycles, when there was harvest time, there would be insufficient liquidity. There wouldn't be enough money because there was no central bank to create money.
You described secret meetings to map out the Federal Reserve before it was established in 1913. Can you tell us about the first name club?
Yeah. So in 1910, Nelson Aldrich was a senator who was the chairman of the banking committee and a very important senator. He and a bunch of Wall Street guys, they went down to Jekyll Island, Georgia in 1910, and they decided it was J.P. Morgan's winter estate. They used it to plot out what would become the Federal Reserve System. And it was so secret that they only called each other by their first names because they didn't want the servants and the porters and things to know who they all were, because if word made it to the newspaper, the fact that there was this conspiracy to create a central bank would have been very polarizing.
Well, so the central bank is created, our Fed, and then World War I comes, and then we go through a boom period, and then comes the Great Depression. Did it change much over the course of those events?
What's interesting, when the Depression rolls around in 1929, 1930, the Federal Reserve System was very new. It was still evolving and figuring out its role in the world, and it did not have a very impressive performance in the Great Depression. I think you can very much blame the fact that the United States and the world experienced such a devastating downturn to the central bankers, including the Fed. They didn't understand the scope of their powers. They weren't well-defined. They didn't understand what their role was to be the lender of last resort when banks were failing.
Well, the European Central Bank didn't exist in the 1930s. In fact, European countries were at each other's throats. But the Bank of England did. How did it adjust to the Great Depression?
Poorly. What happened? The central bankers in the 1930s, they didn't have a common understanding of the challenges they were facing. They didn't have a common framework for how economies worked and what happened when there was a liquidity squeeze. And they had nationalistic distrust. Add to that, they were all committed to a gold standard. They all wanted to keep their currencies pegged to gold, which also meant keeping their currencies pegged to each other. What that meant is that the system was very brittle, and there weren't the kind of the pressure valves as economies fell into recession.
Although Britain had probably the most influential economist of the time, and probably even today, making suggestions. Was he just ignored?
Yeah, John Maynard Keynes, it's interesting. He was largely ignored through the 30s, less and less so as the decade progressed and things became more dire and some of his prescriptions seemed to become more accurate. It's interesting. The Keynes kind of sits over this interwar period in the 1930s as kind of a voice in the wilderness who is becoming increasingly influential. I have a thing in the book. He almost rejoiced when the Bank of England finally dropped the gold standard in, I think it was 1933, because it was finally felt like they were finally seeing some good sense and doing what they would take to get out of the Depression.
My guest is Neil Irwin, Washington Post columnist and economics editor of the Post Wonk blog website. He's written a book called The Alchemists, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. 100 years after the Fed's founding, 75 years after the Great Depression, we found ourselves in another financial crisis. Is there a consensus now on the main causes of the 2008 crisis?
So there's the narrow cause, which was a lot of bad lending and especially in the mortgage sector, which created these securities that were officially AAA and supposed to be very valuable, but in fact turned out to be a house of cards. And as they became less valuable, it transmitted into the banking system. And we all know the story since then. I think there's a bigger...
But people were also playing fast and loose with all sorts of different aspects of banking.
Absolutely.
The hedge funds wouldn't we say deregulation played a major role? Was deregulation an issue in Europe as well?
I think that's true. What you have is there's both deregulation and there's bad regulation. On the deregulation side, there's you know, there's a kind of lack of anybody minding the store as investment banks, for example, become more and more entwined in complex kinds of investments that nobody quite understands. There's bad regulation. There's, you know, in hindsight, there should have been stricter capital requirements. They had capital requirements, but they were badly designed. They weren't stiff enough. So when this shock came, when some of these mortgage securities weren't valuable as valuable as people thought, suddenly we had this entire facade of a banking system that was vulnerable to even a mild downturn and collapsed in upon itself.
In 2008, did U.S. failures cause failures abroad, or had problems in Britain and Europe developed independently?
No, I think it's amazing seeing how this transmitted. And I, to be honest, didn't even understand it fully at the time until I started reporting on this book. What I don't think many people understood is how much all the shady lending that was happening in the U.S. housing market, those mortgages were being packaged and ultimately ended up to a large degree on the balance sheets of European banks. French, German, Dutch banks. And so the minute those mortgages went bad, and it turned out a lot of that lending was not very good, suddenly the European banking system was in peril and was at risk of collapse.
Are we seeing something similar with Cyprus now?
It's a little different. You know, and there it's a case of the Russians and other international people using Cypriot banks as a place to park money. And then the banks bought Greek bonds, which, of course, lost a lot of money. And now the Cyprus banking system is in crisis. But the idea that these things can transmit very quickly across borders in this modern financial system we live in, that's absolutely the same.
Well, you talked about the immediate cause of the crisis. I remember in my history classes being told that World War One, the immediate cause was the assassination of Archduke, Ferdinand.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the real reason. What is your sense of the larger cause of the crisis?
You know, there's been this long series of imbalances that were building up through the 80s, 90s, 2000s. It involves the kind of global flow of capital, this slushing pile of people looking for safe places to park their savings. It involves a kind of financial system which was constantly trying to fix this today's problem and lay the seeds for the future problem. You know, we went 30 years without a major recession, without a deep downturn, and that made everyone in the economy very complacent about risk. It made investment banks take on way too much leverage. It made homeowners buy a bigger house than they could normally afford. This had some really pernicious impacts, influences, and that meant it was a fragile system. So when 2007, 2008 rolls around and it turns out some of those assumptions are questioned, the entire system was vulnerable to a collapse.
Were there similar things happening in Europe? Was there a housing bubble?
Some countries. Spain definitely had a housing bubble, UK arguably.
How different were the crises in the United States, the UK, and EU? For example, didn't Europe have a twin crisis with banks in trouble and EU member states facing sovereign debt crises?
Yeah, this is part of the story of how this crisis kind of started one place and constantly pivots and jumps across the ocean and jumps from markets to the economy to banks. You know, in the EU, it's they actually handled the initial phase of the crisis much better than the U.S. did. They didn't have a Lehman Brothers, for example. They didn't allow any major banks to fail. Their economies, they had a recession. Their recession was not as deep as ours was in 2008, 2009. But since then, this experience exposed some real frailties and weaknesses in the European project, and in particular, too much government debt in a number of countries, Greece being the prime example.
But how does that work in the United States? For example, California was facing bankruptcy until recently. Would that have been similar to one of the European countries going bankrupt?
Well, the biggest difference is, first of all, California was in a much better shape than Greece was because sovereign countries can borrow and run much larger deficits than a U.S. state can. But more than that, you know, the thing about U.S. states is everyone understands the United States is a sovereign nation and that we are going to watch out for each other. There's, you know, ongoing when a bank goes under in Texas, if you live in New York, it's understood the FDIC is going to bail out that bank and that's just the way it is. In Europe, you have a continent of similar size, but you try and tell a German citizen that they're going to have to bail out a Greek bank or bail out the Greek government. That does not go over well politically.
So Angela Merkel is almost as important as the bankers?
Well, she's the chancellor of the largest economy in Europe.
But it's not the same thing in this country. I mean, we Angela Merkel seems to have a lot more clout in regard to the economies of all of Europe than Barack Obama has over the American economy.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, what we've seen, once some of these peripheral European countries got in trouble, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Spain, you know, it put amazing power in the core of Europe. So for Angela Merkel, Nicolas Sarkozy, and now Hollande in France, for the European Central Bank, for the European institutions, suddenly they had to come to the rescue, and that gives them all the power to dictate things they've wanted for years, different changes to labor markets, changes to pensions, better tax collection. It's given them the authority, or the ability anyway, to demand that the Greeks or the Spaniards do those things.
You write that there was a worldwide shortage of dollars that threatened to bring down the entire global economy. How could that happen?
Well, you know, what was happening, so these European banks, for example, were buying all these dollar assets, and then they lost value. They needed dollars, and their banks, the European Central Bank, could only give them euros. So the way that was solved is the Fed and the ECB entered these swap agreements. So essentially, the deal is I, as the Fed, give you $100 billion, my friends at the ECB, you give me a comparable amount of euros in return. You then lend out dollars to your banks. 3 months later, we swap it back, and no harm, no foul. You know, this is something that at its peak, this was, I think, $500 trillion in swap lines extended. This is one of the unremarked stories. This is one of the big stories that if you talk internationally, if you talk to international central bankers, they'll tell you this is one of the key things in solving the crisis from their vantage point. Most Americans don't know about it.
And it's what we will return to after we take a little break, because there were all these secret meetings, and not everybody was in agreement all the time.
Absolutely.
The book, Neil Irwin's book, is called The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. It's published by the Penguin Press. Mr. Irwin is a Washington Post columnist and economics editor of the Post's Wonk blog website. From 2007 to 2012, he led the coverage of the global financial crisis, recession, and their aftermath as the Post beat reporter covering the Federal Reserve and other central banks. Stay with us for more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We are back with Neil Irwin of The Washington Post. He's written a book called The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. It's published by Penguin Press. Ben Bernanke told Time in 2009 that we came very, very close to a depression. What would have officially made the downturn a depression?
You know, I think if we'd had a spiraling series of bank failures, that would have done it. And if we had not had the TARP, for example, that was the $700 billion bank bailout, hugely controversial. Nobody likes it. Even the people who voted for it don't like it. But if we had not taken those steps to kind of contain the damage to the financial system, we could have ended up in a very dark place.
Well, that was a bipartisan decision, and yet it seems to now be treated as though it was something that Barack Obama came up with.
Yeah, and that was under the Bush administration. You know, it was – Obama did execute a lot of it after he was inaugurated. You know, I find it useful to take politics out of this. This was a moment where the U.S. economy was on the brink. I think it's one of the better moments for our democracy, actually, that you saw Congress do that.
And you write that people were on the verge of deciding that money was – itself was unsafe. Is that why gold suddenly became – so expensive?
Yeah, you see a lot of that in this kind of you know, almost paranoid shift toward gold, toward any kind of assets. Even this last few days with Bitcoin, which I still don't quite understand what it is. You know, people. One overall theme of the book and of my kind of research into the world of central banking, money really is an idea, and you know, it's a more fragile concept than we may want to acknowledge.
Now, just a few years before the crisis, in 2005, you write, in Jackson Hole, it seemed as if the world's economic problems had been more or less solved. What happens at Jackson Hole? I thought it was a place where people go to ski.
They do. In the summer, though, the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City for the last 30 years or so has had a conference every August. And it started they essentially get all of the kind of A-list central bankers. So Bernanke goes every year. The European Central Bank head almost always goes. People from countries large and small are there. It's one of these occasions where they kind of discuss what's going right, what's going wrong. In the afternoons, they take a long hike. Their academic papers presented. It's a kind of special gathering that happens every late August. Reporters are there. I've been several times, and it's a kind of a touchstone to understand how their thinking has evolved.
And they were very satisfied that they had resolved all of the world's economic problems.
Yeah, in 2005, think about the world we saw around us in 2005. There had been about 25 years of solid growth in most of the Western countries. Only a couple of mild recessions. Inflation was low. Inflation seemed to have been solved. There had been no major financial crises, at least in the advanced economies. You know, it seemed like this was a world where the central bankers had pretty much figured out how you manage an economy.
And so there was this kind of end of history feeling.
Absolutely.
Did the three central bankers you write about, Ben Bernanke, Mervyn King, and Jean-Claude Trichet, share the problem-solved feeling?
I think so. I think, you know, everybody wants to say now that, oh, you know, we saw there were things to worry about. There was excess leverage, too much debt being taken on. And many of these officials did identify elements of that. But what I compare it to is that old parable of the blind man and the elephant. You know, one feels the leg and thinks it's a tree, one feels the tail and thinks it's a rope, but they don't see the whole picture. I think that's what it is with central bankers during 2005.
And did Bernanke, King, and Trichet make a deliberate decision to coordinate their decisions and their actions?
Yeah, it's a remarkable story. When things became ugly, and starting in late 2007, much worse in 2008, it was very much the case that the leading Western central bankers came together and thought of themselves as part of a team meant to, you know, where it was their goal to try and contain this as a global threat, not to think of it as a threat to the U.S. or Britain or Europe, but all three.
So when the United States became ground zero for the crisis, did Bernanke share everything he knew with King and Trichet?
You know, I'm not in their private conversations. I only know what I've been able to glean from pretty extensive reporting. They were quite open with each other, the three of them. They felt a comfort level, a certain level of trust accumulated over many years that where they could tell each other things that they couldn't tell others.
Well, Bernanke has been praised for increasing transparency, but some of the details of Fed actions in 2008 have only emerged after Freedom of Information Act lawsuits. Why have they kept some of this secret?
Yeah, you know, it's very much central bankers, they're a secretive group. And, you know, here they are, these anti-democratic, unelected officials who wield this great power, and they don't like to tell people much about it. That has changed some, and it has come about partly by force, by legal action, and as you say. You know, I think it's great for America, it's great for transparency that we now know what kind of emergency lending they were doing then. I think at the time, apart from the more general principle that they like to keep their secrets, I think it would have been politically toxic if we had known exactly who was getting all this money back in 2008.
Did they reach out to the other major central banks, the Bank of Japan and the Chinese Central Bank?
I mean, it's a little different. The Bank of Japan has a very deep and rich relationship with the Western central banks. They've had a little different set of economic problems the last many years, so it's a little different in that sense, but there's a great closeness. The People's Bank of China is kind of a different animal. Zhou Chaoshan, the governor of the People's Bank of China, they have a very cordial relationship with him. He speaks good English. They invite him to dinners in Basel, Switzerland, where they have these intimate dinners among the leading central bankers. But there's a little more of a distance. They don't do coordinated actions with the Chinese.
Even though the Chinese are major trading partners with the United States and most European countries.
Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, as rapidly as the Chinese economy has grown, as the speed with which it's become a great economic power, really, it's the second biggest economy in the world, it still in the kind of community of nations is there's still a kind of gap between China and the advanced Western nations in terms of diplomacy, in terms of mutual understanding.
How much influence does a strong individual like Bernanke or King exert over the others in the central bank, the other governors in the Fed? Can he veto their voices, their votes?
You know, it depends on the issue. Bernanke is very much a consensus builder. He was the department chair of the economics department at Princeton. You know, you would joke there that his biggest decision was whether to have bagels or donuts for the faculty meeting. That's really soft selling. What he is very adept at is making sure everybody around the table feels like they're heard, guiding them toward a decision.
Well, was there any dissension?
Absolutely. You know, there's several Fed officials to this day who think that a lot of the actions that the Fed's been taking to ease monetary policy to try and get the economy on track, who think it's misguided. There's four or five, six of them.
And you mentioned a British economist, David Blanchflower, who disagreed strongly with King. How deep was their disagreement?
Profound. Danny Blanchflower, he's now back at Dartmouth. He works here in the U.S. Kind of a provocateur, kind of a big personality. And he and Mervyn King in 2007, 2008 had these just knockdown, drag-out fights. Blanchflower thought that this crisis was going to be very bad and they needed to cut interest rates. King wasn't so sure and wanted to hold back, and they just went at it all the time.
Well, King sounds like he came very close to expressly endorsing policies of David Cameron's conservative government. Do you, Do you think that he acted to bolster the Tory government in Britain?
You know, I think in his mind it probably wasn't about the Tories versus versus Labour. But the result was he was consistently, in the run-up to the 2010 British election, advocating austerity in a way that implicitly implied an endorsement of the Tories and the Conservatives. You know, that's just the way it is. Now, he thought it was just trying to endorse what he thought was the right economic policy. Well, two things about that. It does not seem to have been the right economic policy given what the British economy has done the last 3 years, and it certainly created an appearance of political impropriety.
Well, austerity has been the approach that has been pushed hardest in England, in many parts of Europe, and by a lot of politicians in this country, and it doesn't seem to be working. Why do you think it still has so much of an appeal, considering the fact that it didn't work during the Great Depression?
Yeah, well, there's this deep-seated desire among a lot of politicians and a lot of thinkers to see macroeconomics in moral terms. And you know what the problem years ago was? We were spending too much. Well, clearly the solution is we need to cut back and cut budgets. The truth is what experience shows in the last few years are prime examples. When you do that at a time when the economy is in depression, it can just make things worse. In Britain, for example, not only are they have had essentially no economic growth in the last 3 years, they also have a higher debt to GDP ratio. Even as they've cut the deficit, because growth has been so weak, their debt problems become even worse rather than better.
My guest is Neil Irwin of the Washington Post. His book, The Alchemist: Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. In 2005, Bernanke echoed Alan Greenspan, saying that he saw no evidence of a housing bubble and that the economy could weather a housing slowdown. Mervyn King said that nobody foresaw the bubble bursting. But I've spoken to a number of economists. I spoke to them then and since, who said they were sounding alarms. Why was nobody listening? For example, The Economist reported on a bubble in 2005. Did Bernanke and all the others simply ignore those signs?
You know, it's not that they ignored it. I mean, there was a lot of – if you read the transcripts of the Fed meetings in 2005, 2006, there's a lot of hand-wringing and analysis and running the math and trying to understand what was going on in housing. The truth is they were viewing this through too narrow a lens. They were looking at it as, well, think about what happened in 1999, 2000, 2001. We had a giant dot-com bubble pop. And yeah, there was a mild recession. It wasn't great, but we got through it. It wasn't a disaster either. They were looking at it through the same kind of lens of analysis, not understanding how much the housing market was intertwined with the entire financial system.
Well, for decades, Alan Greenspan was treated as infallible. What was his role in the economic meltdown?
You know, I think his biggest culpability comes in how he ran bank supervision at the Federal Reserve in the mid 2000s. He had very much a view of a light touch. Don't mess too much with what banks do. Private markets have great self-correcting mechanisms, and you know, if bankers are making bad bets, they'll pay for it, and everything will be fine. And that seems to have been mistaken.
And then Bernanke succeeded Greenspan in 2005, just 2 years before the crisis began. Had he changed the course of the Fed in his 2 years up to that point?
In subtle ways. I mean, I think his kind of consultative, consensus, collaborative sort of style had had an effect in terms of making more people feel like they were part of the decision making. But you know, it's a very slow moving institution. I mean, this is not a turn on a dime kind of institution.
The Eurozone has over 330 million people. Britain is far smaller. Was there, or is there, a risk of contagion spreading from Europe to the United States?
Yeah, I mean, we saw this over and over since 2010. As Europe went into crisis and there became a very real risk of the Eurozone imploding and the currency zone collapsing, 60 years of progress toward European unity reversing, that showed up in the U.S. financial markets.
So first, our crisis exacerbated the situation in Europe, and then the European crisis slowed down our recovery.
Precisely. That's what I mean when I say it zoomed back and forth across the ocean.
Many now believe that central banks should be independent from political influence. How independent are the Fed, the ECB, and the Bank of England?
You know, it's funny. Independence is a relative term. On some decisions, I think they are quite independent. On what to set interest rates at, or whether to do quantitative easing or not, there's a good degree of independence to let them try and make the best decision they can without politicians telling them what to do. At the same time, they exist in political systems, and they inevitably end up, interacting with politicians and understanding what the kind of framework of what society will accept might be.
But are they also independent of private influence, like the influence of Wall Street or the City of London?
No. These are people and institutions who end up working in and around the financial sphere. Now, you can argue part of that is necessary. You need people who are going to regulate Wall Street to understand how Wall Street works. So you need some of that. The risk is that there's a kind of intellectual capture, that they think of the world only through the prism of trying to save the big banks, trying to make sure the big banks do okay. That's what's dangerous.
Mark Carney, who's currently the governor of the Bank of Canada, will succeed Mervyn King. He worked at Goldman Sachs for 13 years. First of all, does the selection of a non-Briton reflect dissatisfaction with what's going on at the Bank of England?
I think so. You know, there was a very strong candidates who had worked under Mervyn King at the Bank of England who would have been completely plausible candidates to be the new governor. And they were passed over, essentially, for a foreigner, for Mark Carney, a Canadian. I think that's a sign that the British government wants some change.
Although the minute you say Goldman Sachs, certain people become alarmed.
Yeah.
There have been so many connections between the people deciding on our economic future and Goldman Sachs. Now we're going to have the Bank of England also connected.
Well, also the ECB. Mario Draghi, the president of the ECB, is also a former Goldman alum.
So some people have argued that the Fed has been captured by the financial industry. Do you agree?
You know, capture is it's not either or. It's not a light switch. The question is, how much are they captured and is it to a problematic degree? I think they've made a lot of progress in the last 3 or 4 years toward kind of breaking those bonds. If you talk to bankers, they are not at all happy with the way the Fed is regulating them right now. They feel like they're being ordered to be belts and suspenders as cautious as they can. Is it enough? Is it enough to build a reliable, stable financial system? I hope so, but I think it's there's less capture than there was a few years ago.
Trichet and the ECB wanted to be independent of government influence. At the same time, they were making demands on Greece on fiscal policy. First, what were they demanding?
Austerity, in short, a little more than that. But yeah, it's a remarkable story where the ECB, as a condition of this help that they were giving Greece and eventually Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Italy, they were essentially part of the group telling the Greek government, telling democratically elected officials, this is what you have to do.
Well, do demands like that undermine independence?
I think so. I think it's a very problematic thing to have unelected central bankers who work in secret, who answer, you know, only broadly to elected officials. For them to be dictating to democratically elected governments, here's the policies you have to take on pensions, on taxes, on whatever it might be, that's problematic.
You write about a 1979 lecture by the just retired Fed chairman Arthur Burns called The Anguish of Central Banking. And then just over 10 years later, Paul Volcker spoke on the triumph of central banking. Have we seen a triumph or a failure of central banking over the last 5 years?
You know, I think it's way too early for triumphalism. I would not say it's a triumph. I think look at the world around us. It's 7.7% unemployment in the United States, much higher than that in Greece, Spain. Those countries are in depression. You know, this is a world that is far from fixed. This is a world that has deep problems. I think we could have had things be a lot worse. It could have been a much, much worse. But that's not the same as a triumph.
The Fed has been called the fourth branch of government. Do you think that there's any truth to that?
Yeah, they are an institution unto themselves. You know, they have unique powers in the same way the Supreme Court does. You know, a group of people alone in a room who make decisions that affect us all, same sort of thing.
Well, the difference is that polls indicate that Americans don't realize that Medicare and Social Security are government programs. And I suspect that they don't understand the role of the Federal Reserve either.
Probably not, though. I think they probably know more than they did a few years ago. Most of that is kind of anger at what's been done. It's kind of an inevitable consequence of this kind of extreme interventionism that you're going to see some discontent.
Ben Bernanke's term will end in 2014. How are things progressing toward finding a new chairman?
We don't know. That's you know, that's the president's nomination to make. We don't know if he's even really about it that much, to be honest. What will be interesting to see is how much he wants new blood, the president that is, versus continuity with the policies of the past.
Rob from Brooklyn, a listener, asks what your opinion is regarding David Stockman's New York Times op-ed piece on the possible corruption of capitalism and is blaming FDR and Obama for so many of the problems that we face today.
So I disagree with it pretty profoundly. I wrote this on the Washington Post Wonk blog the other day. I think David Stockman's view is fundamentally kind of nihilist. It's fundamentally he seems to believe that anything anybody has ever done to try and corral the excesses of the market are inevitably laying the seeds for some great collapse. I have a much more optimistic view, to be frank. I think that we can try and make a better world and try and learn from the mistakes of the past, and that it's a kind of iterative thing that we're constantly doing better than we did last time.
Well, do you think it's also an attempt by him to defend the Reagan administration, which he played such an important role in?
There might be some of that, but I think there's also this – there's a pretty widespread view, especially on the right, that there exists some kind of state-of-nature capitalism that everything in the last 80 years has deviated from. I don't think that's the way it is.
Paul Krugman, Joseph Stiglitz, and others argued that the response to the crisis privatized profits while socializing costs passed on to the taxpayers. Do you agree?
I do broadly. Now, you know, there's a different question of is that what you need to do in a crisis to avoid a worse fate? But I think that is true. I think it's objectively true. I think, you know, the even very large banks that have done fine, we don't know how they would have done if things had allowed to progress untrammeled into the fall of 2008. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, would they still be here if the authorities, if the government had not intervened? I'm not sure they would be.
And just one more thing. Simon Johnson thinks that we're already on the path to another crisis. Would you agree with that?
I mean, it's a truism almost that what happens in this crisis sows the seeds for the next one. I don't see any narrow areas where I see huge imbalances happening. I'm more optimistic than that.
Well, the problem is that in the past we've always thought that we've corrected the problem and that it would never occur again. But we do go through these cycles. We can almost be sure that there's going to be another cycle somewhere down the line.
But I can also say that I think it'll be a different kind of crisis than the one we just experienced.
Neil Irwin's book, The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.